From the creators of the hit kids podcast, Who Smarted, and Netflix's Brainchild comes the adventurous world of mysteries about true histories, affectionately known as math. Every episode follows Max and Molly, who have just been recruited into a secret order of problem solvers on an adventure through time, packed with puzzles, hidden equations, history, and laughs, making learning cool. The series explores themes like the stories behind math, critical thinking, code breaking, pattern solving, and more. The shows are perfect for ages 6 and up. We recently returned from a trip where we saw a live pirate show, so our 7-year-old daughter loved the episode about the pirate queen. New episodes drop every Thursday and are about 15 minutes long, perfect for car rides, break times, and bedtimes. Each episode is stacked with so much laughter that your kiddos won't even realize how much they're learning. So tune in to Mysteries About True Histories with your kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Urich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside. I read a phenomenal book called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, and the author, Amy Morin, is here with us. Thanks for being here.
Oh, Ginny, thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, welcome. You have your own podcast called Mentally Stronger. Tell us about it a little bit before we hop in.
Sure. So as a therapist, I just love to talk to people about what helps them stay mentally strong. So every Monday, I interview a guest, might be an expert, an author, musician, celebrity, about how they stay strong. And then on Fridays, I do a solo episode where I share actionable tips straight from my therapy office about how to build mental strength.
That's incredible. Can you think of, and I know it's hard because often there's so many episodes, but like one or two standout ones that people are like, I want to go, where am I going to jump in? Where should I start?
Oh, so there is an episode about how to build mental strength in general. I forget what number it is. It's probably like number 30, somewhere in there. I think it's called The Ultimate Guide to Building Mental Strength. So for somebody who's new to mental strength, that's a good place to start. Mm-hmm. And then I have some other ones that are about, I guess, like how to deal with worry. Get a lot of Friday ones about anxiety, worry, that sort of a thing. So for anybody that worries, I don't know what number that is offhand either, but it's in there.
They'll find it. So the Mentally Stronger podcast, it's a great resource. And then you have this book that I read, The 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. But then there's a whole series. The next one that came after this one, because it's there's like in mine, which is obviously a reprint because it's a bestseller. And so mine has a little snippet of the next one you wrote, which is for parents. And then there's one for women, kids, couples, a workbook. So you can go down the rabbit hole here. Can you tell us, Amy, what is the difference between mental strength and mental health?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question because people often get them confused. People will come into my therapy office and say like, oh, I wish I could be mentally strong, but I have depression or I'm battling anxiety. But it makes more sense to us when we think of the difference in terms of physical health and physical strength. Like, yes, you could go to the gym and you could get big muscles. But of course, nobody doubts the fact that you then still might develop high blood pressure or high cholesterol. Like the two are not mutually exclusive. So mental strength and mental health, the same. Building mental strength can help you become mentally healthy. Doesn't guarantee you won't ever get a mental health problem. And if you do, it's not a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a pretty interesting distinction. So psychotherapist, college psychology instructor, clinical social worker, contributor to Forbes, Psychology Today. You have so many things going on. And this book and this whole series of books, which is an interesting title and it just an interesting twist. The topic is things that mentally strong people don't do. So instead of what do they do, this is what don't they do. Can you tell us why you took that twist?
Yeah. So as a therapist, I was taught to really build on people's strengths. So if they come into the therapy office, like figure out what they're doing well and just build on that. That sounds good in theory, but at some point, if I were to, again, relate it to physical exercise, I thought, you know, if I went to the gym and I worked out, that's great. But what if the trainer didn't tell me, hey, by the way, all of that junk food you eat all day is really counterproductive? I'd be mad. Like, I don't want to keep running on the treadmill for extra hours if I didn't have to. So I thought, you know, I'm doing people a disservice if I don't help them identify the little habits sometimes. Sometimes it's minor things that are keeping them stuck. So I started paying attention, like, what's the difference between people who come into my therapy office and they're often thriving? And some of them, even if they went through really difficult things, they were still doing okay, or they had some hope. compared to people that felt like they were stuck in life. And one of the biggest things was what they didn't do. People who were doing well just didn't have certain bad habits, and their good habits were just so much more effective because of it.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. It starts off with like not having a pity party. That's one of the first ones. So 13 things, and they will probably talk about a few of them, but not all 13. People can go read the book, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. You've had a hard life.
You know, I had a wonderful life, I think, with a difficult decade, to say the least. Yeah. It was easy for many years. And I think like so many people, that's just that a roller coaster of the best and the worst of the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this book comes out of experience. This is not something that you're making up. I mean, you really went through it. And you talked about how I knew plenty of people my age who hadn't lost anyone, but you lost many of your loved ones, your mother, your husband, widowed when you're in your 20s, and then your father-in-law. You married Steve, and then it's his dad, right? And he had cancer.
Yep.
All within a very, very short period of time. And so this book about mental strength really comes from a lot of your own experiences and what you've learned. I was impressed, Amy. This book is filled with stories. I mean, story after story after story. And I know you meet a lot of people, but it was like stories, maybe people that you meet, but also stories of famous people that everyone knows. I was like, man, she just packed this in with stories, which I love because stories really help you remember. One of the stories that will stick with me was about this first one. The thing that mentally strong people don't do is they don't waste time feeling sorry for themselves. And so the story is that you're coming up on, your husband had passed. It's coming up on his 27th birthday. It's big emotions for everyone. What are we going to do? And I think for most people, it's like, well, we're going to sit around and cry. That's what we're going to do. And his mom said, no, we're not going to do that. What did she suggest?
She said, let's jump out of an airplane. And so we did. And his grandmother was going to go with us, but she just had cataract surgery. So they wouldn't approve her to go. But she went and watched. But the three of us went, and his mom and I went skydiving. My husband had been this really adventurous person.
Yeah.
And the thought of just spending his birthday sitting around and being sad just didn't seem like something we wanted to do. So we said, let's honor his memory. And we couldn't really think of a better way to do it. And so we did. We jumped out of an airplane and felt like, hey, we actually turned it into a day that empowered us to say, all right, yeah, like, let's do something on his birthday. Because I felt like when my mom passed away, we never really found a good way to honor those days, her birthday or her anniversary with my dad, things like that. And so, and my sister's a therapist too. And so it's kind of like, even when those days rolled around now, like we might call each other, but we might not even say anything. And I don't like that. I didn't want it to be like that. So I said, you know, like, let's figure this out. And I'm so glad that we did. I think it was one of the best things that we've done. And even to this day, my family and I, my Lincoln's family, will still do some kind of adventure. We've done lots of different things over the years, from like taking flying trapeze lessons to riding mules into the Grand Canyon. But we turned it into something where we invite friends and family, and it's become a day that we look forward to rather than a day that we dread.
That's really beautiful. I talked to someone recently, she talked about opposite action. And that's what I saw here, which is that we're making a choice to do things opposite of how we feel. When you feel self-pity creeping into your life, make a conscious effort to do something contrary to how you feel. And even your grandma, it was Lincoln's grandma.
Yep.
She went zip lining.
She did. Yes.
She was like almost 90.
Yes. And she was all, oh, I could do that. That sounds great. And bless her, she did.
She did. Well, it's interesting too, because you talked in the book, and it was in a different chapter, about just this sort of need for control. And your mom had passed and Lincoln passed. An interesting story, like I said, just woven with stories. The story was, is that your parents' house caught on fire, something in the basement, smoke damage. I have a friend who just recently, her chimney caught on fire. So the whole house didn't go up in flames, but everything is smoke damage, and they come in and they touch everything.
Yeah.
So you were saying, oh, it really bothered you because it's your mom's stuff. And the same with Lincoln. It's like, you know, there's not a way to make any new memories with them, but maybe the things that they leave behind leave little clues. Because interesting that this is a way to make new stories in his honor.
Yeah, it was something I struggled with because, as you say, when my dad's house caught on fire, my mom's stuff was, a lot of it was ruined. And then when Lincoln passed away, it was like this desire to make the house more like a museum. I didn't want to take down his coat from where he'd last left it, or to move his toothbrush or anything like that, you know, because I thought, I don't want to do anything that would make me forget about him. And as a therapist, like, I know I wasn't going to forget about him, and that the last scrap of paper he wrote something on wasn't him. But at the same time, it was painful to get rid of those things and to have to figure out, what am I going to do differently in life? How am I going to move forward? What am I going to sell of his versus what do I keep? What do I still carry around with me? So many questions like that had come up, and figuring that out of how do I honor it without staying stuck in that place of pain.
And if there's anyone I think who could have then lived a life of self-pity, because here you are in your 20s, you're a widow, you've lost your mom, you get married, your husband's losing his dad. How did you avoid that trap of just taking your life and feeling sorry for yourself all the time?
I knew that there's that myth that like time heals everything, and it's not true. But so many people would come in my therapy office, and it might be a decade after they'd gone through something, and they were like, Amy, I don't feel better. How come? I've waited all this time. And the problem was that they waited. And I knew that just like waiting to feel better doesn't do any good. And I could have easily just waited for two more decades until I felt better. But I also knew that grief is the process by which we heal. Like, you have to go through the pain. You can't go around it. So I had to find that balance of letting myself experience sadness and pain without letting myself feel sorry for myself, which was then be about saying, oh, my life is so much worse than anybody else's, or my problems are insurmountable. My life will never be good again. And I, of course, had those thoughts, but I didn't have to entertain them or stay stuck with them. And certain things over the years, I think, also gave me those light bulb moments of hope, like, okay, maybe I could build a new life someday. And different things that would just remind me that, like, you know, despite the fact that I lost my mom and I lost Lincoln when I was young, at least I had them in my life, period. I was a foster parent when Lincoln passed away. And there was a time where I had a foster child in my house. She was 14 and she'd already lost both of her parents. They had both passed away. And I can just remember thinking, like, gosh, you know, here I is this kid. I can't imagine what it would be like to lose both your parents in completely different for completely different reasons by the age of 14, and then you end up in foster care. Like, oh,
yeah.
So those sorts of moments of just reminding me, like, you know, I'm grateful that I had them in my life. I'm very sad that I still don't have them. But at the same time, how do I want to honor their memory and live life to the fullest? Because if I learned anything, it's that life is pretty short, and you get just one opportunity to say, how do I want to spend my time and who do I want to spend it with?
And I think a lot of people talk about how their time in nature, you're talking about these different things, like all of those different options were things that you did, you know, taking the mule into the Grand Canyon. And a lot of people say that in periods of grief that they find solace in the things that they do outside. You say, do something active. This is probably one of my favorite sentences in the book, Amy, where, because I never thought about this, because you're like, okay, you know, if you are the type of person that wants to have a pity party, which I think we all do at times, right? You're like, okay, you're like, here are all the reasons why this is not going to help you. It's not going to help you in the long run, all these different things. And then you said it interferes with relationships. Who has ever said, what I really like about her is the fact that she, I thought this is so funny because it's so true. Like, you would never say this. What I really like about her is the fact that she always feels sorry for herself.
Right? And yet I think sometimes we think it's like a good way to commiserate with people is to be like, oh, you're not going to believe how awful today was. And like, but really nobody's looking forward to those phone calls to hear how awful your life is over and over again. If that's what it is self-pity.
Yeah, that was good. Oh, that was a good sentence. I'm like, I never thought about that. And I thought that was great. So that's one of the things. And even in this one, you talked about, and we're dealing with kids, there was a story. So they're not all your stories. It's all sorts of different stories in here about this child, and he'd been hit by a school bus and broken his leg. And he's, you know, in a wheelchair for a bit and struggling to recover. And the way that the parents handled it made it worse. So this kind of ties in with the second book, which is 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do. But as parents, you know, our kids are going to have bumps in the road. What are the ways that we make it worse?
By treating them that they're fragile. And I know I had to do this too as a foster parent. Like, the kids who came into my house had been through the most unimaginable things that kids should never endure. So my tendency then was I just wanted to put them in a bubble to make sure that nobody made fun of them, that they didn't have to get ridiculed for anything, that they didn't have any problems. I just would love to have made life really easy for them. But if I did, I wasn't doing them favors. But I see this a lot with parents who come into my therapy office too, where they'll say, well, you know, my kid went through a divorce. We got divorced last year. So now they're scarred for life. So I have to treat them like they can't handle certain things, or I feel bad that they had to go through something. So now I want to make up for it. And because of that, kids miss out on the opportunities to build skills. But also, if you treat yourself or somebody has always treated you like you were fragile, then you don't put yourself out there and do things and grow and learn. And we don't want, that's like the last message we want kids to grow up thinking is like, I'm really fragile and I need somebody to protect me. We want them to think, no, I'm strong enough to handle whatever curveballs life throws my way. I've got this, not I can't handle it if something bad happens.
Mm-hmm. I like how in the book you would point out these certain things where in doing what we do, we and make it worse.
Can you hear my phone ringing really loudly?
Oh, no.
Oh, maybe it's, sorry, maybe Zoom just blocks it out then. Otherwise,
oh, when I heard a little bit, it's okay. It's hardly noticeable. Do you need to get it though?
No, I don't. It's just annoying. Sorry.
Okay. What kind of a room are you in?
So I live on a sailboat.
That's what I thought. You're on a boat.
Right. So it's my living room in my sailboat.
Where at? Where's the sailboat? Is it floating or is it parked?
It is. So I'm in the Florida Keys, but I'm tied to a dock. So I'm not like bobbing around out in the ocean. But
how long have you lived in a sailboat?
8 years.
What? Does everyone know this?
Yeah. It's,
okay. I like, yeah. They listen to your podcast. They know you're living on a sailboat for 8 years.
Right. Yeah.
Is this what mentally strong people do?
Well, they do spend time in nature. And what a better way to spend time in nature than to move on to a sailboat, right?
Yeah. I'm like losing my train of thought here, but this is really, have you sailed all over then? I mean, I would imagine.
So no, we mostly, because we're in the Florida Keys, we mostly just stick around here. And I live on a boat that can make water and do the whole thing. So if I wanted to sail around the world, we could, but that's not really my shtick, isn't to go on a long voyage. But yeah.
Wow. I have been thinking about this the whole time. So I'm so glad your phone rang. So I got to ask. Okay. That's so cool. Amy, what a life. Wow. I love that. I don't know anybody else who lives on a sailboat. So that is really incredible. Okay. So we're talking about Jack. Well, so one of the things is that sometimes we make it worse, right? So you had said about him, they allowed the accident to take away even more. The way that his parents were dealing with it, it was like he already had the accident. And by the way that they're dealing with it, it's actually making things worse. And there was another story about someone who was dealing with their mother-in-law. And she was making it worse because she was spending all sorts of time talking about it. And that was taking even more of her time. So this is Jenny. I'm sure the names are changed. But you said she would spend 5 hours a week with her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law's doing some of the mother-in-law type things or criticizing or overstepping. And then it said she was devoting at least an additional 5 hours thinking and talking about her disdain for her mother-in-law.
Right.
So this is, I mean, this is the whole thing, right? We're making it worse. This is like an issue of control and also just not making decisions to people please all the time. This is a really big thing. It's a big topic, right? Because we deal with a lot of people in our lives. So how do we deal with the ones that are really bugging us?
Yeah, well, that's a great question because it's not so easy as being like, oh, I'm just going to cut these people out of my life or anything like that. In reality, you can't. You might work with somebody that you think is kind of annoying or you have a family member that you're not going to cut out of your life, but you don't enjoy the fact that they call you on the phone 16 times a day. So part of it is about setting boundaries and limits, but part of it's also about sometimes just changing the language that you use. So when we say something like, oh, my mother-in-law makes me feel bad about myself, like maybe she says some things that you think are rude, but you don't have to let it tear down your self-esteem. You can decide, do I need to speak up and say something or and set a boundary, or am I just going to ignore her and try to let it roll off my back? But we always have options. And I try to work with people on figuring out, do I need to solve the problem or solve how I feel about the problem? Mm-hmm. So if you're working with somebody and you really struggle to work with them, or you have somebody in your life and it's really difficult to be around them, to figure out, do I just need to manage my emotions better? Sometimes that's the answer. It might be your mother-in-law and you only see her for a couple holidays a year, probably manage your emotions and figure that out. But if you have a brother-in-law who suddenly moves on into your living room couch because he's struggling and it's causing problems, you might decide, okay, well, this has become a problem. We need to figure out how to handle this situation. And it might be about setting a boundary or helping him move up back out of your house. So it's really important, though, to ask ourselves that question and to get realistic about it. Like, when do I just need to, maybe I need to increase my frustration tolerance, or maybe I need to decrease the amount of time I spend with somebody, but come up with an action plan. So often we think we're just the victims, like, oh, I have this awful person in my life and I can't handle it. And then, like in the situation with Jenny, you start thinking about him more, you start dreading him more, and suddenly this person's taking up so much room in your life, and it might just be their mental real estate. You might only see them for an hour a week, but you're dreading it so much that suddenly you're spending hours still thinking about that person, and that's the last thing you want to do. You want to make sure that the people that take up your life, whether it's your mental real estate or the people you're physically spending time with, are the people you enjoy, the people that you want to spend time with.
Oh, that's a lot of clarity. Should I solve it or solve my feelings?
Yeah.
That's a lot of clarity. And it really boils it down. You got two options.
Right. And sometimes a lot of our suffering comes from the fact that we take the wrong approach. We don't like somebody else's behavior. We're like, I'm going to fix them. And we're like, no, don't try to fix somebody else. Or we are in a really unhealthy situation. We keep thinking, oh, it's me. I can't manage my emotions. But really, if you're in an incredibly unhealthy situation, it might be that you need to change the situation sometimes too.
Oh, yeah, we picked the wrong one.
Right.
That's a good way to boil it down. That's so interesting.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. It could be relational stress, stress from your job, or just the feeling of overwhelm we all experience at times from everyday life. I sometimes experience healthy or not so healthy doses of stress when I'm reading multiple books, trying to get ready for a day of podcast guests, preparing a keynote presentation, or sometimes just packing up everyone for a conference trip. When we keep those feelings of stress bottled up, it can really start to affect us negatively as well as those around us. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. And it's not just for those who've experienced major trauma in their lives. If you're feeling stressed and thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/1000hours today, and you'll get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/1000hours. Hair thinning is complicated. The problem is, it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker, stronger hair. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for only 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OUTSIDE. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com is spelled NutrafoL.com. Promo code is OUTSIDE. That's Nutrafol.com. Promo code OUTSIDE.
So one of the things that you talk about too is just control. And I think that a lot of times, especially when the world is changing rapidly, that we tend to want to try and control more because we feel nervous. We feel nervous for the future. We feel nervous for our kids' future. And so that is one of the things that mentally strong people don't do, is they don't try and control everything, which kind of goes hand in hand with perfectionism, which I think is something that people struggle with quite a bit. And I think it's a really big one. You know, it's like struggle with being perfect in things, I think it's a really hard thing to drop. When your clients come in and they're trying to control too much and they're struggling with perfectionism, how do you help them start to lead their way out of that?
Yeah, it's a funny thing that sometimes when we have a little anxiety, we try to control more than we can. And the more we try to control things and we can't control them, the more our anxiety builds. And it creates this cycle of always trying to control everything. And in some ways that manifests as somebody saying, like, if I could just be perfect, then yeah, I'll finally feel good enough. Or if I could just do this thing perfectly, then other people will recognize how amazing I am. And obviously that's not realistic. None of us are perfect. You're never going to do anything perfectly. And giving yourself grace and using self-compassion, those are all the tools that we really need in life. Yeah. But letting go of control is hard. It's really hard to say, you know, I'm going to focus on throwing a good party, but I can't control if people have fun, or I'm going to make all these plans this weekend, but you can't control the weather. And letting go of that means I have to feel uncomfortable because it's uncertainty. None of us like sitting with uncertainty, and myself included. And just knowing, like, okay, I'm going to have to learn how to tolerate that uncomfortable feeling. And again, I guess that goes back to knowing what to focus on. Sometimes it's not about trying to change the situation. It's about knowing I'm going to focus on my emotions, not trying to fix the external environment. I'm going to work on me.
I loved that list that you had, the list of what you can't control. And I thought it was really good. It started with that one, right? Which was the party. I was like, oh, yeah. You can give your child tools to be successful. You can't make them a good student. You can do your best at your job, but you can't force your boss to recognize you. This is a big list. And I think these are a lot of the things that sometimes we struggle with, right? You can be the smartest person, but you can't control people listen to you, follow your advice, right? You can't control your competitor. So there are a lot of things that are out of our control. But I just liked your thing. And I think this is what you've done with your life. Practice acceptance. This goes back to the choice, right? You may not like the situation you're in, but you can choose to accept it. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And I think there are a lot of misconceptions about acceptance, because people will think, well, if I accept something, it means I'm saying it's okay that it's happening. But sometimes it's just about accepting it is what it is for right now.
Yeah.
So for somebody who, say, has a toxic mother, at the age of 55, she's probably not going to change her ways. You might have to accept, my mother's not the kind of person who's going to give me what I wanted, or she's not able to have a reciprocal, healthy relationship. You can accept that is for what it is right now. Doesn't mean, mm-hmm, all right, 10 years from now, maybe she does change. But for today, mm-hmm, this is what you're dealing with. And a lot of, I think, more suffering in life comes when we dig in our heels and we think, oh, this isn't fair. This shouldn't be happening to me. Or this person, they can't behave that way. That's not right. You're right. It, mm-hmm, might not be right, but you can accept this is who they are today. This is what's in front of me. And I guess the easiest way to boil acceptance down would be, you're in a traffic jam and you can either say, this isn't fair. All these cars should get out of my way. Or the acceptance part would be, you know, there's millions of cars on the road and sometimes traffic jams are going to happen. And then you turn on the radio and you make the best of it, because, mm-hmm, either way, you're not going to get out of that traffic jam any faster. So you might as well enjoy whatever cards you've been dealt to the best of your ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good analogy. There was one even where there was a car accident. It was like, yeah, you back into someone else in the parking lot and one person says, ah, you know, why would that happen to me? Of course. And then the other person says, oh, what a great thing. No one got injured.
Right.
It's the way that you're looking at it sometimes. Although sometimes it might not be great, like you're saying, but accepting where you're at in that moment. Okay. This was something that I thought was kind of interesting / confusing. So there's a section about being a people pleaser. So it makes sense if you're a mentally strong person that you wouldn't probably be a people pleaser, because then you're giving away a lot of your power and your own authenticity and what you want to do with your life. But you say it stems often from a desire to be liked by everyone, which is actually more selfish, much more selfish than saying no to someone. I don't know if I've ever heard anyone talk about it that way.
Yeah, it's almost like if you ask me to do something and I say yes, it's almost like, because I think you can't handle the no, right? And I'm doing something, it's really more about me than it is about you. If I don't want to do it and I do it anyway. And it's easy to become bitter and resentful of all of these things you're doing for other people, but why are you doing it? It's probably for admiration, praise, to be liked by them, makes you feel good. It's not necessarily a completely selfless act to say yes to all of these things. either. Mm-hmm. We might want to appear that way, but deep down, it's like I'm saying, you know, you're too fragile to handle me saying no. If you invite me to go somewhere tomorrow and I say, oh, okay, I'd love to go, even though I don't want to, it's because I think you can't handle me saying no. But the truth is, I'm not that important. Me saying no to something that you invite me to do, Jenny, is probably not going to crush your life. I suspect you'd pick up the pieces and be just fine. But basically, I'm saying I am so important that you couldn't handle it if I said no.
Hmm. And that the decision is based off of sometimes what we want the perception of ourselves to be to others.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that was really interesting. So, okay, when we're going outside, we're taking a lot of risks. Often. Our kids are, for sure. You know, they're outside, they're doing different things that seem risky. I think we've become a society, especially with our kids, like you were talking about earlier, just kind of like trying to treat them like they're fragile, and we're not really doing anything that's very difficult because we don't want to fail. And in this one, you talked about Dale. So many good stories. This was really good. And it went a place I wasn't expecting. Okay, so Dale's a teacher. He's kind of burnt out of being a teacher. He wants to change career paths, and he doesn't because he's terrified of giving up a stable job. Do you have a lot of people that come in and talk to you about dreams that they have that they're just not doing?
All the time. People who said, you know, I always wished I could write a book, or I wished I could have gone into music, or I wished I could have, or I thought I would have been a good teacher, but I never dared try.
What do you tell them?
You know, we talk about that, like, because I do believe there are limitations. If I decided today I'm going to be an astronaut and I'm going to go to the moon, like, it is probably not going to happen. And it's not sure. Because I didn't try hard enough. Or if I said I'm going to be an NFL player next week, like, no, that's not going to happen for many reasons. So I do think there are times when we need to accept, all right, this isn't going to happen. But on the other hand, sometimes we just need to back up and say, well, let's look at the evidence. Like, what evidence do you have that you could possibly do this thing? What evidence do you have that you couldn't? And we'll write it down, because just seeing it on a piece of paper sometimes can help us say, well, you know, I've got this much in this column and only this much in this column. So maybe it is possible. Or what are the barriers to doing that? Sometimes people say, well, I don't have time to write that novel. Do you really not have time, or you just tell yourself that because it's scary to sit down and actually write the book? Hmm. So we might problem solve that. Like, if you had a half hour a day over the course of 2 years, could you write that novel? Where could we find 30 minutes? Maybe you don't go on social media, things like that, to help people figure that out. And I think some people will then come to the conclusion too, like, you know, I've held on to this dream for a long time, but maybe I don't want to do the work it would take to get there. And that's fine. You can come to that conclusion too. Maybe you don't want to be a triathlete. And you decide, I like the idea of it, but I don't actually want to do the work. That's okay too, if you don't really want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you said people are like, oh, I wish I was this athlete, right? And you're like, do you really though? Because would you really want to be the one that's like, you can't eat this and you got to train this amount of time? And so when you really think, sit and think about it in a rational way. And so this Dale, he had several ideas of different jobs that he wanted to do. And then he did. He tried to fit it in on the side, and it brought fulfillment in other areas of his life. This big sentence was, he didn't calculate the emotional toll that avoiding risk was having on him. So I think so often we look at things like, this is a super responsible thing to do. I'm not risking anything. And so everything is stable, and aren't I great? But then you really are struggling because you feel unfulfilled. And that was seeping out into his teaching.
Yeah. So I will encourage people sometimes to say, well, what's the cost of not making that change? Like, if there's a change in life you want to make and you're thinking about it and you're kind of on the fence, sometimes we're like, ah, it seems too risky, but it's risky to not make the change too. So what are you risking? Maybe 10 more years of not being happy? Are you risking that in 10 more years, you won't ever attempt to try this dream? Might you be unhappy? I don't know. But sometimes when people look at it that way, they're like, oh yeah, actually it is risky to stay put too.
Yes, it is. There was some sentence about 10 years in a day, you know, it's like you wasted 10 years. Don't waste 10 years in a day. I can't find it. It was a good quote. I just butchered it, but it was really good. And it's in here. So but this is a concept of, are we being too emotional about our risk taking and not throwing in a little bit of logic there and thought? And I would say probably one of my favorite stories in the whole book was about the dog, about Jet.
Yes.
Animals are funny. Tell us about Jet. He like wouldn't walk on the tile.
Yeah, so Jet the Yellow Lab was so strange. He had a fear of walking across a tile floor. So when I moved into a house that had tile floor, he would leap from carpet to carpet. So we had to put out throw rugs. So he would have like little lily pads. Like he would jump from one to the next.
And he would not walk on it. Not to get his food, nothing.
Nothing. And he loved food. He was very food motivated, but would not do it. And so, but then the problem became that because he was jumping from little throw rug to little throw rug, that he would try to get a running head start. It was almost like he didn't understand it. And then the rugs would slip and then he would be scared again. And so it was this vicious cycle of trying to teach Jet that the floor was not actually risky.
Which is just a good analogy because it just was illogical. And I thought it was really funny because then there was one where it was like he would walk backwards yep. in certain instances. And so sometimes our emotions are not rational, like the dog. But we talk about risks. One of the things that you did as a younger person was you gave a speech. I thought this was a really brilliant thing to do. Give a speech, you're valedictorian. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's amazing. Valedictorian at high school. And you got to give a speech and you're afraid. And so I thought you did something really brilliant to get yourself over your fear. What did you do?
So I was terrified in my head. All I could picture, I hated public speaking. It was beyond my worst fear. So in my head, all I could imagine was that I would get done speaking and it would be so quiet that you could hear a pin drop and not even anybody was going to clap. So in my head, that's what I kept playing over and over again, that I would give this awful speech, nobody would clap, and then I would sit down and it would be the most awkward moment of my entire life. So I convinced some of my friends that when I was done speaking, that they would stand up and give me a standing ovation. Even if they were the only three people that stood up in the audience, they were going to cheer like they were at a rock concert. And thankfully, I have amazing friends who are still my good friends to this day. And they did that when I was done speaking. And it's sort of like the rest of the audience followed suit because when a couple people stand up, more people do. And it was like when I went into the talk, I was like, you know, I'm not even going to be that nervous going into this because I knew the ending was going to be at least a couple people are going to cheer for me. And that's what got me through it. I think otherwise, I don't even know that I would have found the courage to get up on the stage. But thank goodness for my friends who agreed to do that.
I think it's kind of a brilliant idea. I was like, maybe I should do this. I've got five kids. I was like, I could plant them all the way throughout the audience.
See, it takes all the pressure off. Then you know.
It totally does. You said on cue, they stood up and cheered like they just witnessed the best rock concert in the world. Was it earned? Maybe. Probably not. And to this day, it doesn't matter. The point was, is if I could get rid of my biggest fear that no one would clap for me, I could get through the speech. I thought it was brilliant, though. I mean, you're in high school. You were able to boil it down to what exactly the fear was.
Yeah, because again, I just kept thinking like, what is the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario is the silence at the end. And so if I can control that one little thing, I'm going to do it. So I guess even back then I knew to focus on what you can control. I've got three people in the audience that will do what I ask them to do. And I knew that they would. And at the risk of embarrassing themselves, they leaped out of their seats like they were at a rock concert. So, and I trusted that they would do that. So I think sometimes, you know, when we're in a risky situation to figure out like, what could I control? Is there just one little thing? And sometimes that's all it takes for us to feel better.
Yeah. And what is the biggest fear? What's the baseline fear there to figure that out? Okay. You talked about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which we just went there, which was super cool because it's always fun when you've been to a place and it's in a book. So
right.
Like I talk about in this book, you're talking about your personal stories, the stories of other people that you've come in contact with, and then famous people. So Hershey failed several times. Walt Disney failed several times. I mean, this is the story of the world. Like if you want to be successful, you're going to have to deal with some of those things. So failure is a thing that runs in this book as well. So people are interested in that. You're going to find a lot in there. But then also just about this piece of solitude, which is an interesting one because I think in this day and age, especially with so many devices and technology, I think we could go a whole life without experiencing solitude. What does solitude do to help us become more mentally strong?
It's really about being comfortable with your thoughts. Because even when I talk about solitude, people will be really quick to be like, I love my alone time. And then you say, what do you do when you're alone? And they're like, I scroll through social media and I'm talking to my friends. And so I should have clarified when I was talking about solitude that it's really about being alone with your thoughts. So it might be just going for a hike in the woods without your devices. Sometimes just the thought of that for people raises their blood pressure sky high. They're like, wait, but what would I do? I can't do that. Because we've gotten to a place where we are so distracted and you can have a million things going on that it's hard to be alone with your thoughts. In fact, they did this study. They asked people, would you rather be alone with your thoughts or submit yourself to an electric shock? And like 25% of the women were like, I'll take the electric shock. And then 75% of the men also opted for the electric shock.
Wow.
Over 15 minutes of solitude to be alone with your thoughts. So I think it is a problem for a lot of people, even people who say, well, I'm an introvert. But again, what are you doing? You're watching TV, you're doing like things that are just flooding your mind so you don't have to think. It's important though. We spend so much time planning certain things in our lives. Like you might plan a wedding or you plan a birthday party, but like, do we really plan our lives or do we really step back and say like, what goals do I want to work on and how am I doing? How'd I do today? What do I want to do better tomorrow? So a little bit of alone time can help with a lot of that, but I think it also gets us in a space where we get to know ourselves better. So much pressure to somebody says, where do you want to eat lunch? You're still thinking like, oh, they don't like Chinese food, so we'll pick the Mexican place. There's always pressure from other people about the things we say, what we wear, how we act, what we say we like and don't like. But when you spend time alone, you get to make all of those decisions. And at first that can feel kind of overwhelming and almost scary. But after a while, people will say, oh, I kind of like that. Even if they go out to dinner by themselves, they think, I get to make all the decisions about where I'm going to sit or which restaurant to go to. And it can become freeing, but a lot of people have to work their way up to that. Sometimes you start out with 5 minutes of alone time and then you work your way up to taking yourself on a date once in a while all by yourself.
Which I've never heard of that. That idea was in the book. I thought that's kind of neat. Once a month, schedule a date with yourself, or even just once a year or some. I mean, I don't think people do that ever. I thought about the things that I like to do. Like, would I ever just go kayak by myself? Like, I'm always trying to work it out and work it out with other people. And so, yeah, that would be really freeing. And also for kids. So you touch on that in this book. Fifth to ninth graders who spent moderate amounts of time alone were less likely to exhibit behavioral problems, scored lower on depression rating scales, and had higher GPAs. That's a lot of benefits.
And I think a lot of people think it's the opposite, right? We're worried that kids have to socialize more. So we're constantly trying to keep them busy and active and make sure that they're around other people. And that's super important. We want to make sure kids do have all of those opportunities. But it's also equally important that they can sit in a room by themselves for 10 minutes without their devices or without feeling like they need somebody to entertain them.
Yeah, because we used to have opportunity for that all the time, you know, in decades past, because there weren't devices. And so there was just time built in where you were alone with your thoughts.
Right.
Even if you're just sitting in a car driving somewhere,
right,
there's time built into life innately. And that is possibly not there at all now if you're always allowed to be on your phone or certain things like that. So you said this is really helping with mental strength and mental health. The ability to tolerate alone time has been linked to increased happiness, life satisfaction, and improved stress management. These are big benefits. People who enjoy alone time also experience less depression. So I like that. I like that you gave these practical ideas, like, you know, take yourself out on a date and go have dinner. Occasionally you see someone by themselves at a restaurant, and I always tend to feel sorry for them. But maybe this is actually a really good thing.
Maybe they're enjoying it. I have to say, I travel a lot for speaking engagements now where I don't orchestrate the audience standing up. But so I travel for work. And so I end up going out to dinner and doing a lot of things alone. And I just get used to it over time where I think, oh, yeah, it's actually there are some benefits to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, special things. You get a little bit of time to think and organize your thoughts and work things out.
We all know that there are things in life you have to compromise on. The vacation rental that has super tiny bedrooms but an amazing pool. The grocery store that doesn't carry everything you want but is closer to home. Or listening to the same song over and over to keep your little ones engaged in the car. But when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines just because they're available right now or because they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable listening to you and prioritize your health. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book with them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual, real patients. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 74 hours. That's it. You can even score some same-day appointments. If I needed this product, it's what I'd use. So go to ZocDoc.com/hours and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/hours. ZocDoc.com/hours. It's no secret. We love music in our household. And music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. That's spelled VoetBerg MusicAcademy.com. And use code OUTSIDE when you sign up.
So tell me about, you write this book. It's wildly successful. 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. Take back your power, embrace change, face your fears, trade in your brain for happiness and success. And then it becomes this basically series of books. So when you go to reframe and you're going to write it for parents, you're going to write it for women, you're going to write it for kids, for couples, how much of the themes sort of overlap versus how much is, like, there's some differences there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a great question. So they're all different except for the kids book. So the kids book is basically how do you grow up to not do the 13 things mentally strong people don't do. So that's my only book that's phrased in the 13 things strong kids do instead of don't do.
Yeah.
But my other books are a bit different. So when the first book came out, the biggest question I got was, how do we teach this to kids?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to write a kids book right away because I thought, well, if I give you a book and you hand it to your 8-year-old and they read that book, that's great. But if they don't have somebody to reinforce those skills at home, we're not going to get very far. And I really wanted to teach parents, how do you become a mental strength coach for kids? So readers asked for it. So I created the book for parents. But then after the parenting book came out, I had a lot of people say, well, we know like what it looks like to be a tough person, like a Navy SEAL or an athlete. But a lot of those people are men. Like, what does it look like to be a strong woman? And so that book is really about the societal pressures that women experience that are a little bit different, or some of the bad habits that we might dive into just because of the way that we've been raised. So although I've had plenty of men say they found the book helpful or that they could relate to certain things too, it's really about the everything from not owning our success. Sometimes we know we minimize things, or when it comes to compliments, we're much more likely to be like, oh, it was nothing, rather than just say thank you as compared to men.
I just read a book that said men don't ever do that, ever, never.
And then it's like 90% of the time women do that. And so, and the study that really made me decided I had to write that book was they asked 5-year-olds to point to somebody who's brilliant, and they give them a whole bunch of pictures, and all of the little boys point to a picture of a man. All of the little girls pick out a picture of a woman. And then at age 7, they say, same lineup of pictures, point to somebody who's brilliant. And all the little boys and all the little girls point to men.
Wow.
And you think, well, what happens between 5 and 7? They go to school. And what do they start to learn? They learn about astronauts and presidents and all sorts of important people who tend to be men. And so little girls are getting that idea that men are brilliant, and that just breaks my heart. So I really wanted to write that book so that we could start to raise girls to teach them that women are brilliant and that they can do so many things that maybe they don't think they can. And it's subtle little things that we often do to treat them slightly different. So that's why the women's book came out. And then I knew it was time to write the kids' book after that. So the kids' book, and then so many people were saying, well, we want more. So I wrote a workbook about the 13 things mentally strong people don't do. And then finally, the most recent one was people were asking about relationships. So I said, ooh, let's write the couples book then that will really focus in on how do you be mentally stronger for yourself, but how do you also build a stronger relationship with your partner?
Which book was the hardest to write?
Ooh, maybe the couples book. Even though that was the most recent one and it was number six, it was a little more complicated because sometimes it's like I struggle with this. Sometimes it's like my partner struggles with this. Sometimes we both struggle with this, or sometimes we both might be struggling with it, but we don't want to talk about it. So that one was a little bit more complicated to get into the nuances of what if you think your partner does these things, but you don't? Or what if your partner is accusing you of doing this, but you don't think you do? So that one made that one a little bit more of a challenge than some of the other books.
Mm-hmm. So then have people stopped asking, or are they still asking? Like, what about the situation, or what about that?
I still get so many people asking like for more books. Like people will say, can you write one for teachers? Can you write one for senior citizens? Can you write one for teens? I get that one often, which I absolutely agree with. So it's been interesting because that's how I've never really had to come up with a book idea. My audience always tells me what they want next. So I feel like I'm incredibly blessed by people who are interested in mental strength because their questions help me figure out what we need more of.
I mean, that's almost 10 books right there. You throw those extra ones on there.
Right?
Teachers, senior citizens, and teens. Yeah, I think that's a big deal because where people are struggling and they do need help with, I think, their mental strength and their mental health. But this is definitely a different way to look at it. So for the parents book, we're talking about part of it is probably modeling, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what people were saying is like, well, I'm just learning this for the first time myself. How am I going to teach my 8-year-old how to do these things? And so I really wanted that book to be about like, how do you let kids deal with pain? How do you teach them how to cope without just throwing them to the wolves? But on the other side, how do you teach a 10-year-old you're upset? How do you help them calm down without taking responsibility for their feelings? And we know that when they have surveyed college kids, like 90% of them say, I was academically prepared for college. Yet the vast majority of them say, and I was not emotionally prepared. They say, you know, I can do math, no problem, but I don't know how to deal with a roommate issue or when I'm lonely or when I'm sad.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly disheartening that we're sending kids off who don't have those skills. So my hope is that parents will have the confidence now to say, oh, yeah, I know how to help you deal with that. Or let's figure this out together. Let's solve some problems. Or what can I do to make sure that you're getting these skills? Because we weren't taught this. And so for a lot of us, like, I don't know, we didn't really talk about feelings in my household either. So it wasn't until I went to college that I learned a lot of these things myself. So I don't blame parents for saying, you know, I'm kind of at a loss and I don't know if these things I'm telling my kids now are working or if they're helpful or not. So my hope is that that book will give parents that confidence so that they feel like they have the skills and tools they need to be a mental strength coach for their kids.
Sure. Well, and childhood is short, but it's also long.
Right.
I mean, if you talk about something 15,000 hours of school or something like that, it's quite a bit. So you're like, well, okay, the time is there. And some of it should probably go toward these skills, these like life skills that confront you all the time as soon as you become an adult of how to deal with this situation and how to deal with that. I would imagine that screens has come up. I've read now in several places that screen uses is probably the biggest source of conflict in homes these days between kids and parents. What advice do you have in terms of being mentally strong as it relates to screen usage and kids?
Yeah, it absolutely is a huge sticking point for so many families. So I think it's important to have some rules, come up with general rules about we're not going to check our phones during dinner, or we're going to have certain times where we stay away from our screens. It might be on Saturdays until noon. We're not going to stare at our screens. But the tricky part is the adults have to try to follow those rules too. Yeah. And I know that's tough because parents are like, yeah, but I work. I have to check my work email, or I have to have my phone available in case the other child calls. So it's tough to try to set those rules. But I think kids are looking at us to say, what do you do in your spare time? When you're in the grocery store and there's a long line, do you whip out your phone? When you're bored, do you take your phone out? And they're looking to us to see how we cope with our emotions, whether it is boredom or loneliness or anxiety. And those are all opportunities for us to say, okay, I'm not going to look at my phone. I'm going to teach you something about how to cope with frustration right now just by modeling it. And kids can learn a lot from that when we start setting those limits. Mm-hmm. And then to not let kids take their phone to bed with them, because at 2 a.m. Yeah. when your 15-year-old gets a text message, they really want to reply because they don't want to be the uncool kid who didn't reply to a 2 a.m. group chat.
Right.
But kids are actually usually kind of relieved when they're like, well, my mom puts all our phones in a basket at night, so I don't have my phone. And then it kind of lets them off the hook that they don't have to say, I was sleeping and I'm not going to answer you. So I think just coming up with some general rules, and if you get kids involved in it too, they're often very invested. If you create a contract that says you can have a phone, here's the rules, what do you think the rules should be? They're usually way more honest than you think that they would be about, well, here's this, this, and this, and here are the consequences. And there's research that will show that too. Just write up your own contract. You can put it on a piece of notebook paper and you have both of you sign it in a way that says, here's the rules, here's the consequences if you break those rules, and then follow through with that too.
That's really good advice. Really good advice. And I think that the fact that you wrote your books in that order, it lays out that foundation of it's got to be the parent first.
Yeah.
The parent has to be mentally strong first before you can teach your kids. So that makes a lot of sense that you would start with that book, and we start with ourselves, and then we're modeling this for our kids. Actually, I was just thinking, I meant to tell you at the very beginning, my editor is the one who recommended your book. Isn't that fun?
Oh, really?
She was like, you should think about writing a book like this.
Cool.
You know, I can't quite remember how she said it, but it was one of her favorites. So she made sure that I got a copy of that right at the beginning. And I've really just so much enjoyed it. 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. Amy, I so appreciate your time. Here you are on a sailboat, hanging out with us. It's fantastic. We always end our podcast with the same question. What's a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside?
Oh, let's see. So I grew up in rural Maine, where there was lots of outside time, tons of it. And so I had an ATV. I drove a four-wheeler as a small child. Talk about taking risks. But I used to go exploring. We had tons of land and there was trails in the woods, that sort of a thing. So I used to go exploring on a four-wheeler all the time as a kid.
That is so fun. So much freedom. I love it. Amy's got the Mentally Stronger podcast. People can check out new episodes every Monday and Friday. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.